Well, up next, our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, joins us. We get his reaction to the NASA announcement today. We'll be back with Richard in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, 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 here's Richard C. Hoagland from the EnterpriseMission.com and our science advisor. Richard, what do you think?
Where do you want me to begin?
Oh, well, first of all, you know, as I was telling Bob Zuckerman, I was kind of let down. I don't know. Were you?
Yeah, Tom came on and he says, aren't you really let down? And I obviously really disappointed him. And I said, no. And of course, then I said, I'll explain on the air. And okay.
All right.
I am actually very encouraged by this. Look, I have a huge number of fans and friends on Facebook tonight, something like 20,000 people. All of whom have been beasting on me and this whole thing all day long that, oh, this is a pile of you-know-what, and, oh, it's a big letdown, and, oh, it's a big to-do over nothing, and NASA's hiding everything, and they have the courage of a tufted titmouse, which gives tufted titmouse a bad name, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What these people, and I count probably a lot of the Coast audience in this same camp who are unhappy and despondent and let down and mad and all those other emotions tonight.
Sure.
What they don't understand is that we are a minority of this planet. The folks, you and me, George, and the folks listening to us, and my 20,000 Facebook people, and all the other people all over the world who think like we do, are a tiny, tiny minority of the 6 billion plus people breathing and sleeping and eating and doing other things on this planet tonight.
I agree.
Of those 6 billion people, 99.9% are going to be, when they hear about it at some level and it's properly explained, they're going to be dumbfounded by this as the announcement was intended to be. You know, your friend Zimmerman in the last hour tried to explain valiantly. Bill Nye tried to explain to Lawrence O'Donnell on Lawrence's show on MSNBC earlier this evening that this is one of those big things come in small packages kind of stories. I mean, George, the real story here is not that they found arsenic-loving bacteria in Mono Lake.
That's why you're on tonight. Come on.
The question is, why are the bacteria in Mono Lake arsenic-loving? Why everywhere on this planet, only in Mono Lake, are there apparently bacteria that love and eat and actually are formed on the element of arsenic?
So what does it tell you about that spot?
Is it possible that this is an actual extraterrestrial life form which happened to find its right niche in Mono Lake after falling down from the skies like Vikrama Singh and Fred Hoyle and others have been postulating there are bacteria floating through space and they've got high altitude balloon samples and they've got all kinds of models and they've got curves showing how virus activity goes up on Earth and we pass through various meteor showers and comet tails and all this. Is this, in fact, where NASA's next shoe, as one of your callers in the last hour said, that they're going to announce next that they found the source of this little bacteria, and it's not earthly. Mm-hmm. It's not from here. In other words, is this more drip, 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 drip? Because, and I know all the people out there are yelling at the radio now, oh, my God, they think we can't handle the truth. Yeah, that's what they think. They really think that this planet will go nuts if it is announced in any way, shape, or form that all the other stuff that you and I and this whole audience know is out there, including very sophisticated life forms running around in very sophisticated spaceships, leaving very sophisticated ancient ruins at one time all over this solar system, if NASA were to announce that. So where do they start, George? How do you start from square one when you have essentially painted yourself into a corner that we're the only life form in the whole galaxy, nay, the whole universe, Mr. Scott?
So you do what they did today.
You got to start, and this is not the beginning. This is part of a series of revelations. Remember the Pope wanting to baptize aliens?
Yeah.
I don't think he was talking about bacteria.
No, he's doing
that. You got to look at this, everybody, come on, let's be adults about this. You have to look at this as a mainstream incremental step to eventual disclosure.
Think this is a programmed, planned
Absolutely. This
episode.
Is a ritual, right out of the ritual playbook. And I'm going to prove later on in this hour that this is part of the ritual. Remember, I wrote with Mike Barra a New York Times bestselling book called Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA.
How could I forget? Barra tells me all the time. Every time I meet him.
Because it's true.
He's a bestseller.
By the way, I hope his new book, The Choice, is doing very well.
I hope so, too.
Anyway, in that book, we document, going back decades to NASA's beginning and beyond, that if nothing else, this organization is an incredibly religious, ritual-bound organization. I'm going to demonstrate later in this hour that this announcement, this big deal for the mainstream, is in fact part of that ritual playbook, and they're following their playbook, and the next steps along this road are going to be even more interesting. And at some point, yes, we all get pregnant. It's just not tonight.
What's the timetable? When do they begin to leak?
Well, the timetable began a long time ago. I mean, if you go back to the origins of NASA, this is kind of incorporated in their founding charter, and I don't have time to go into the details there. You can go to enterprisemission.com and just read the charter. Where I think this is coming out is this magic end date where so many other things come to a head, some kind of a climax, i.e. 2012. I think the magic ritual playbook NASA's operating on, which they cannot change, they must follow it line by line, rule by rule, order by order, edict by edict, is that by 2012, we get pregnant. And they've got to lay, as the lawyers love to say, foundation. They have to put themselves politically, George, in the position that they have discovered all this stuff just like all the rest of us are discovering it. And guess what? Most people will buy it. Now, this audience...
If you're going to cook a frog, you simmer him, right? You don't boil him right away. He'll pop out of the pot.
Yep.
So you just do it nice and slowly, and that's what's happening to us.
So I see this as a positive affirmation that my drip-drip model of disclosure is alive and well and lives in Washington, and they are following the ritual. And I'm going to prove tonight with several examples how incredibly, absolutely, infallibly they have to follow this ritual. They cannot deviate by one, you know, to quote our religions madly here, jot or a tittle. They cannot change what has been written down. And they're following the playbook, and this is another dot along that line as I analyze it tonight.
If that's the case, whose playbook is it? Who's calling the shots? And how big is the picture, the ultimate picture?
Well, if I was going to be simplistic, I would say it was a Masonic playbook, but that doesn't really explain to people who haven't read Dark Mission what we mean by that.
Right.
What we have and what we proved in Dark Mission is that there are several groups within NASA. They're not predominant groups. Most of the system is honest. Most of the system is recoiling hearing me even say this because they haven't a clue as to what's going on and the agenda of why certain things are done the way they are done. But there is a minority, a very powerful minority in the agency composed of three levels of ritual-loving folks, the Masons, the Magicians, and the Nazis. And for the details on how they got incorporated into NASA, go back and read Dark Mission or go to enterprisemission.com, and there's some papers there, and you'll find a kind of a paper trail. This is not a secret. This is not, you know, just look up on Google paperclip, and you'll find all you need to know about the Nazi contingent. That playbook is, I believe, and Mike concurs with me, as does Jim Mars and several other people who've looked at all this, is extraordinarily ancient. It is hundreds, if not thousands, of years old. And it portends from a time when knowledge that the human race was not alone was common, except it's common only among a tiny elite handful of people who think the rest of us, until recently, didn't deserve to know. Something in our analysis, something says from our analysis that there's been a change in that mandate, in that instruction. And now there is an effort at Warp 9 to bring the mainstream, remember, most of those 6 billion people tonight who think we're all alone, that there is only one form of life on this planet, it was ordained by God, it lives here, and there's nothing anywhere else out there except lots and lots of, as Jodie Foster has said in that Contact movie, a lot of empty, wasted space. If that's true, if that model is true, then we will see more robust forms of this meeting today, this announcement. and they will get us closer to becoming pregnant. And the drop-dead date for that is, of course, 2012.
So between now and 2012, then you expect even more announcements, more information coming.
If the model is to be confirmed, and, you know, we're looking at a lot of dots behind us. You know, we've been talking for months and months now of all the things. Remember Stephen Hawking talking about hostile aliens, like out of Independence Day?
Yes, absolutely. And also saying we have to leave the planet.
And we have to get out there, yes. Yeah. Then, of course, you have the Pope saying he would be willing to baptize aliens. Well, that opens up such a can of worms, epistemologically, philosophically, theologically. I mean, we don't even have time to go there tonight. But the bottom line is, I think we're on a disclosure curve. I think it is woefully, woefully underestimating the ability of people to be resilient and to handle the truth. But we're dealt the cards we're dealt, and we got to use the hand that we're dealt. We don't have other cards. So for those that are expecting that there's going to be, you know, huge stuff coming, yeah, there is. I just can't tell you when. I do think this is a very critical benchmark because it's the first time that NASA has grappled with the concept, what is life?
Yeah.
And finding an organism which somehow has incorporated a completely different element into its DNA satisfies Sagan's criterion. Remember what Carl Sagan said about E.T. life?
Well, he
that
said
if we
it was
found as much as a bacterium independently evolved on Mars, mm-hmm. it would mean the galaxy was teeming with life?
That's right.
Well, how do you define independently evolved? That means it has a different DNA. So I'm thinking that there's a surprise contained in this science article, which is ultimately they're going to reveal, you know what, guys? That organism in Mono Lake, turns out it's actually not from here. And at that point, people will say, oh, well, we knew that all along because we heard that months ago that there could be. See what I mean?
I can tell you, that makes a lot of sense because if, you know, you scan the planet and everything has our own genetic makeup. Everything, the DNA is the same all over the place. Everything's all over, except this little lake. I mean, what does that tell you? It sounds like the Andromeda strain to me.
Well, yes, exactly. Now, let me raise the stakes here. What if there's been some quiet experiments going on for a number of years?
There?
Substituting other elements in the base pairs of DNA, just like arsenic now in this little organism can, you know, supplant phosphorus. What if, in fact, you can replace carbon with silicon?
All
Robert
right.
made a small mistake when he said that it was to substitute for oxygen. Silicon actually is much more like carbon, and there have been proposals going back decades and decades for silicon-based life forms in, you know, good old science fiction. The Horta on Star Trek, which everybody is talking about, it's interesting to see Star Trek coming into the mainstream at some point.
Oh, I love it.
That was the main idea, was that silicon, which has much higher heat resistance than carbon, could form the basis of a living organism that lived in a planet that tunneled in hot, you know, conditions deep inside. And
like Venus, right?
Yeah, you could say Venus. In other words, when Bill Nye said to Lawrence O'Donnell earlier tonight, this really opens up the idea of planets where you can have life, he's actually not kidding. For the mainstream, again, you got to look at this as a mainstream person just hearing about this on the news or reading an article on a blog site or whatever is going to react. Their world now has been expanded because, my gosh, life is no longer typical, terrestrial, normal DNA-type life forms. There's an alien in our midst. Now, do you remember a few months ago there was a Royal Society conference about aliens living amongst us?
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about bacteria?
Here they are.
Isn't that what I just said?
Yeah.
Wasn't that a foreshadowing, another foreshadowing, another drip? That in fact, ultimately, we may find organisms that are not from Earth. How would you know them? Well, they would have to be based on a DNA level that would be different. This is about as different as you can get. Now, what I'm wondering is, could we replace oxygen in DNA with fluorine? Because you want what they call electron donors.
Mm-hmm.
Could you replace the carbon with silicon? And has somebody in a laboratory already done this, George? And those are the next drip data points waiting to be announced breathlessly like this press conference this afternoon.
If you were running the show, would you be doing it the way they're doing it now?
No.
You would not.
Because I think the reason, and I think Zimmerman did touch upon an important point, he got from the net the angst out there, the anger, the disappointment.
Yes.
And he
and you did too. You did too, though.
Well, yeah, right? Of course. But see, he is attributing it to the fact that the journalist overhyped this. No. NASA very carefully and very consciously put out a press release that was misleading as hell for everybody that knows they're sitting on all the good stuff.
But they made it sound by omission that it was a bigger story.
They wanted people to make the leap. Doesn't Robert get it? No, because he doesn't think NASA's a political agency. This was done with absolute forethought to get everybody to leap to the conclusion. And then when what was announced was actually announced, everybody goes, oh,
exactly.
Is that all?
Exactly.
What's the first thing you do in presidential politics if you want to win the presidency? Since you have announced you want to be president, I would think you would know this.
I have not announced that. There's been speculation.
You undercut expectations.
I have not.
You create the reality where what you announce and what actually occurs are light years apart. Therefore, when you get to the really big announcement, everybody's going to go, oh, we knew it all along.
Yeah.
They're aiming politically so people do not freak out, run naked in the streets, you know, fulfill art's worst fantasies when it comes to religious dogmatism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is being done on a ritual-based curve, and after the bottom of the hour, I will reveal to you how I can absolutely claim that as fact tonight as part of a series of other facts, which I'll get to when we come back.
Well, I got to tell you, Richard, your theories, can I call them that?
Sure.
Hold as much credence than anything. Nobody in that conference speculated simply by saying, where did this bacteria come from?
No.
Nobody.
It was the missing elephant in the room.
Yeah.
If you scour the Earth, and NASA has had an astrobiology program for decades, if you've been scouring the Earth, looking at all the extremophiles, all the bizarre environments, the first thing you would do when you get an organism is to take it into the lab and take its DNA apart and take a look and see if it's from here, wouldn't you, if you're running an astrobiology program?
You would think.
Why didn't anybody raise the specter this afternoon that maybe this little guy fell out? Is because it's not time to admit there's any little guys out there yet. They've got us on the very dumbed-down disclosure track. They are absolutely going to stick to that timeline. And as agonizing and impatient as all the rest of us, you know, become over that, realize that this is a positive. This is a plus. They're actually getting to the point where they're going to have to get pregnant. And I think between now and 2012, you're going to see it.
And do you think that this bacteria that lives on arsenic, that it's only situated in this little lake?
Well, we only have data, as Robert would say, for this one lake. We don't know if there's any other environments. You know, I mean, someone asked earlier this afternoon, why Mono Lake? Well, Mono Lake is, as David Lawrence said this afternoon, is about 6 hours drive from San Francisco, right, up toward the mountain. That is the site of a lot of gold mining, silver mining, et cetera, et cetera. Arsenic is found in those placer claims that you can, you know, see the tailings left by the miners in the, you know, the 49ers gold rush.
1849.
And it has concentrated because of runoff into Mono Lake. Now, what I'm wondering is, did an opportunistic organism that has arsenic in its DNA fall from space, find this one little oasis on a planet that was inhospitable to it anywhere else and is thriving only in Mono Lake because it actually came from the stars? It came from somewhere orbiting the sun. It came from outer space. That was not even addressed this afternoon. It was like,
of course
it's a terrestrial organism, and it's simply mutated.
That would have been one of the bigger stories. Richard, we'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got Richard C. Hoagland this hour. Next hour, Tom Horn joins us. Nephilim stargates. the year 2012 and the return of the Watchers. So get ready for that. We'll be back with Richard. We'll take some of your phone calls and continue chatting with him about the Mars News Conference today, about the NASA News Conference today, about the bacteria in the California lake that seems to live well on arsenic. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. So, Richard, explain your thought pattern here on the upcoming announcements as they begin to dribble us with information.
Well, look, science begins in pattern recognition. The pattern that we recognize for decades now is that NASA is at heart a ritualistic organization. Not the engineers, not the scientists, not the secretaries, not the guys who sweep the floor, not the contractors, some of them, but the hierarchy that gives orders inside the agency, going back to its formation in 1958 under Dwight Eisenhower, is provably, demonstrably ritualistic. Let me give an example. I have on this show in the last couple of weeks talked about the curious weirdnesses around this next shuttle mission that were disturbing me that didn't kind of make sense.
Right.
And I have not wanted to really hit it on the head because I was looking for more data, looking for more of the pattern. Well, this mission, the final mission of Atlantis, is to be the transition mission from the old NASA pre-Obama to Obama's agency. It also represents the transition from Newtonian physics in their ritual symbology to a post-Newtonian physics. It also is a transition from mission 132 to 133. Now, you know, in Masonic lore, 33 degrees, et cetera, is very important. We don't have to get into why, but we all know that as a kind of a starting point, that 33 is a key number in Masonic tradition, right?
Right.
I can barely hear you.
Oh.
Okay.
I can hear you.
Okay. So I'm looking at this mission, and I'm looking at its symbolic transition between a Newtonian reality, which basically says that energy has to come from fuels and sources, and a post-Newtonian reality, which says that energy is actually coming from space, i.e., free energy, hyperdimensional physics, torsion physics, et cetera, which is canonically celebrated in this transition between the previous shuttle mission and this mission by means of the number of the shuttle tank, which is 137. You know, the shuttle missions have their numbers, and the tanks have their separate numbers.
Right.
When they're fabricated down in Louisiana. This is tank number 137. Well, why is 137 important? Because 137 just happens to be the fine structure constant of physics, which Richard Feynman once characterized as the most crucial but mysterious number in all of physics, bar none. Well, we know from the work of a physicist in Australia that the fine structure constant actually now is a key, transition between normally known physics and hyperdimensional physics. This physicist has found that black holes in galaxies all over the universe, reachable by the world's biggest telescopes, have a ratio of 137 between the size of the galaxy and the size of the black hole in their center of the galaxy.
By the way, Central Time, Richard, as you were saying it, it was 137.
That's intriguing. Anyway, so 137 is a big deal. Feynman even had a license plate with 137 on it. Like Sagan had a license plate with Phobos on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at this and I'm saying, okay, because on mission 132, the previous shuttle mission, NASA actually conducted a Newtonian ceremony. I bet you didn't know that.
I did not.
They took a little plaque with a piece of wood from the apple tree, supposedly under which Newton sat in England centuries ago when the apple apocryphally fell and hit him on the head, and he came up with the theory of Newtonian gravity.
It's got to be petrified stone by now,
that,
huh?
They took a little piece of this petrified tree on a plaque given to them by the Royal Society of England, and they flew it on mission 132, and they had a ceremony in the space station over the anniversary of Newtonian physics, leading, of course, to the next mission, the one we're currently waiting on and still waiting, which is going to be mission 133. And, of course, in Masonic tradition, the step between being a 32nd degree Mason, when you basically still know nothing, and being a 33rd degree Mason, which you have to be invited in to become a 33rd degree, is everything. All the big secrets are in the 33rd degree, but not every third to third degree is created equal. And again, go back to Dark Mission for the details and all of that. Point is that this is a stunningly ritualistic organization. Now, here's a capper in this story. 137 is a prime number. Did you know that?
Yes.
It is the 33rd prime.
You and those numbers, Richard.
The numbers are how the ritual is written and how they're following the ritual. Now, would you like to know the atomic number of arsenic, the element that is being substituted in the DNA of this little organism living in Mono Lake?
What number would that be?
33.
Interesting. Let's take a few more calls here, Richard. You're one of a kind when you come up with these. Bend, Oregon. Kate, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Katie.
Hey, I'll be quick. First of all, I think it's Enrique Fermi is a physicist, and he said the only thing, I'm paraphrasing, the only thing more outrageous than thinking there is life elsewhere in the universe is thinking there isn't life. But my question for Richard, since these bacteria are living on arsenic, does that mean they are not carbon-based, or that they are on our planet, they are carbon-based?
Well, they are carbon-based because if you look at all their DNA, everything is the same except the phosphorus element in DNA, which every other organism on Earth has to have to live, has been kicked out, has been made disappear, and arsenic, the element arsenic, has been put in its place to replace the phosphorus. So if you came across this organism, let's say on Mars or on Titan or anywhere else in the solar system, NASA would automatically, based on the difference in the DNA, say this was an extraterrestrial organism. But because they found it on Earth, for some reason they're not saying that yet, and I'm simply saying that's what they already know, and that's the next shoe that's going to drop somewhere down the line, because they don't think we can handle the truth at anything but an eyedropper speed.
Richard, what would a silicon-based life form look like? I mean, would it look, you know, would it have our makeup, or would it be totally different?
Well, I mean, again, now we're back to Zimmerman's thing where he hates to speculate. Unlike Zimmerman, I think speculation is the heart of all good science. Without good speculation, you wouldn't have science. The science comes in when you check your speculations, when you make a model, when you make predictions, when you go looking for stuff that you speculated might exist. That's how this biologist from Harvard, I forget what her name is, who made the announcement today, she got onto this because she thought the unthinkable. What if an organism could literally subsist on arsenic as opposed to phosphorus? And lo and behold, she went and found an example. So I don't know what a silicon-based life form would look like. I mean, when you think of silicon, you think of high temperature resistance. You think of resistance to acids, to things that would eat it. So it would probably be a much more durable life form. The problem has always been to get the level of technology to actually substitute silicon in DNA. See if it would replicate. And it sounds to me like we're at the edge of that technology, where perhaps a whole bunch of organisms have been quietly created, and this is only the first of an announcement that this is another model now, that this was not found in Mono Lake, that this is the cover story. In fact, this is a created organism, and they're about to announce some others that they may have created in some other context. The problem is we don't have all the facts, because there's something about this that appears to be, as everybody's visceral reaction has been, such an underwhelming reaction to such a big implied story by NASA itself. Remember, NASA wrote the headlines. The science writers did not write the headlines. The NASA press release said this was a big deal. Well, it is.
It is a big deal.
But not in the way everybody was expecting. But I think that's because they were expecting the end game, and we're still in, as one of my Facebook friend this tonight said, Christy Gardner, she said, oh, this is nothing but NASA foreplay.
The biochemist that you're mentioning, Dr. Felisa Wolf-Simon, what made her key in on this lake? I mean, of all the places to go, how do you find this lake? to do this?
Well, Mono Lake is well known to have bizarre chemistry because of the gold mining and the placer mining, all that took place in Northern California, you know, 100 and some years ago. So we know there are dangerous levels of these heavy metals around this lake, and that's not the only lake that where we have these conditions. But it was one of those places where you look for extreme organisms. There's a whole branch of science now called extremophiles, where people like Carol Stoker, a friend of mine, you know, from the Mars Society, and others have been looking under very exotic conditions, deep caves, you know, exotic high temperature, acidic ponds, stuff like this, for organisms on Earth that might be analogs of alien ET organisms that could live on other planets, i.e. including Mars or maybe even Venus. So looking at Mono Lake was not that unexpected. What was totally unexpected is finding not just an organism that can survive in Mono Lake, in other words, has developed some kind of a chemical barrier against the deadly effects of arsenic, but has apparently incorporated arsenic in place of phosphorus in its very DNA. That's the big deal here. It's not that it eats arsenic, it's that it lives with arsenic incorporated in its very DNA.
Yes.
That's the big deal.
Let's go to Manassas, Virginia. Jeremy, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. You're on with Richard C. Hoagland.
Hello, George.
Hi, Jeremy.
I have a question for Richard. Earlier on the show tonight, I was curious what you meant by now in 2012, what you meant by pregnant, everybody being pregnant. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, when I say pregnant, I mean NASA admits that we're not alone, that there is bacteria out there and higher organisms, which in fact are part of the cosmos that we inhabit. And they kind of let us in on the fact that there's a lot more data and that they have been quietly developing, a la the Brookings Report, a careful educational public campaign to acclimate people to the idea, which was the Brookings recommendation back in the 1950s when NASA's first report was done at the behest of the Brookings Institute. So that's what I mean by getting pregnant. They announce that we basically are not alone. How we get from here to there, here meaning the end of 2010, when Arthur C. Clarke said 2010, the year we make contact, to how we get to we are in fact not alone, I use this loose metaphor, getting pregnant. Now, these are the things I'm going to be talking about on the cruise into 2012, because 2012 appears to be an end date for a whole bunch of these how should we say, milestones. And the 2012 date in many contexts appears to be a kind of an endpoint. And I think that NASA has as its endpoint for getting pregnant 2012. And that's one of the things I'm going to talk about on the cruise, which, George, you have very curiously not asked me about tonight.
Not yet, because I'm still doing my checking on the cruise.
Okay.
I've got some engineers working on some things. You know me. I'm a good poker player. Next, we'll go to CJ in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Richard's hometown. Go ahead, CJ.
Hey, what's going on? First-time caller from Albuquerque, 21 years old. Mine's open already. Already know all these beings are everywhere. So I was have my question was about Planet X and the theories of the Illuminati waiting for the planets to align. And Planet X is supposed to come through and not only do the pole shift later on, but it's supposed to have moons behind it. So that might be even extra give for the Illuminati. And is this, and maybe NASA might even know it's happening recently. Maybe the date is off, but it's happening now. Because why would you tell them the day is going to happen? Everyone would be ready. They weren't trying to throw us off.
Richard, I haven't heard you talk about a Planet X ever.
Well,
do
because
you?
It doesn't exist.
What do you mean?
It's a chimera. It's not real. The whole Planet X thing comes from, you know, Zach Sitchin's work, God rest his soul. And we, you know, I demonstrated in Monuments that the way he described it, it could not exist because it would have long since disrupted the entire solar system, in which case we would see evidence, and there's no evidence of this disruption. What we instead see is evidence of a planet that once existed between Mars and Jupiter, blew up. Mars is one of its moons, et cetera, in terms of the Tom Van Plandern, you know, exploded planet hypothesis. So no, I don't buy the Planet X idea at all, because the effects that are being attributed to this mythical planet, in fact, are hyperdimensional effects, which are intrinsic to the Earth itself and its angular relationship to other members of the existing solar system, the galactic center, planets out beyond Pluto that have not been found, which are not Planet X, which are in fact in circular orbits, although highly inclined, and the Planet X, as the canonical model states, you know, coming through the solar system, dripping comets, et cetera, wrecking havoc and Earth changes, it does not exist.
That's all right, next up, we go to Bellingham, Washington. We'll get two more callers in. Ray, you're on with Richard C. Hoagland. Go ahead, Ray.
Hey, man, how are y'all doing tonight?
All is well.
I've talked to you a few times, and I love your program. I listen to it every night.
Thank you.
My comment, you know, I really, man, this is just what's going on right now in this day and age. But one question I want to ask you is the face that they discovered on Mars that appears to be it almost looks exactly like the face that is on a Sphinx. Now, who were the ancient Egyptians, the Sumerians, those who were here before Adam and Eve? Because there were the good crops before the good crops, according to scripture. That's what who put that face on Mars? I've seen it. I've seen the pictures of it.
Well, there's nobody better, Ray, than Richard C. Hoagland to talk about the face on Mars. That's one of his first works many years ago. That's another story, Richard, and another time.
Well,
I
just refer him to Dark Mission and the Monuments of Mars, and all his questions are answered in those two books. Everything you would ever want to know about the face on Mars is in those two books.
About a minute and a half or so to go. What is new with your cruise?
Say again?
What is new with your cruise?
The cruise is going to be involved. Well, first of all, people who think they can wait until March to book, you can't. It turns out in the cruise business, which I'm learning a lot about, you have to book earlier, you don't get a cabin. So I would strongly advise people to call an 800 number. Let me see if I can get the number here, which is 866-348-4638. That's 866-348-4638. And book a room, book a cabin, book one for two, give it as a Christmas gift or whatever. The other thing you can do is to log on to www.cruiseinto2012.com, and you can find information there. But I know a lot of our audience is not on the web, and so the 800 number, the 866 number, 348-4638 is important.
Super, Richard.
What I'm going to personally present is some of this new ritual information, which I found goes back even before the genesis of NASA. I have now got connections between 2012 and the expectations of the U.S. government and several major private philanthropic organizations like the Rockefeller Institute, the Carnegie Foundation, et cetera, who were up to their eyebrows in 2012, and I'm going to be describing that as part of my presentations. I'm also going to have 7 days, George, with a whole bunch of people that listen to this show, and what I'm planning to do on the upper deck on some of the nights under the southern skies is star parties. Have you ever been to a star party?
I've been to one star party, Richard. I had a blast. It's a great time. Richard C. Hoagland, enterprisemission.com. I'll be back in just a moment with Tom Horn as we talk about the Nephilim stargates on Coast to Coast AM.